Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. One of this nation's great civil rights leaders insists that racial tension and inequality may be worse now than ever, even with Barack Obama as president. We'll visit with Julian Bond, the former head of the NAACP, later on this hour. First up today, the plight of America's cities. Bruce Katz, the Brookings Institution, believes that as Washington infighting continues, power is actually slipping away from the nation's capital and into the cities. Cities, not states or the federal government, Bruce says, are the new pace setters. Bruce Katz is the vice president and founding director of the Metropolitan Policy Program for the Brookings Institution. He's the co-author of the new book, The Metropolitan Revolution. He speaks in town on Wednesday night. He joins us this morning from Brookings. And Bruce, nice to have you back on the show. Welcome back.
Well, thanks for having me.
You say that the power dynamic in this country is actually shifting, that the federal government and the states were once the adults in the room and the cities were the children. You say that's turned completely upside down. How so? What are you seeing out there?
Well, I think we're going through a profound shift in the United States. I mean, there's no secret to anyone listening to this that our country, your metro, faces supersized challenges, a jobs deficit, opportunity gap. But we're seeing the national government essentially leave the building. I mean, not really capable of even basic governance, let alone grappling with some of the big issues before us. The good news is across the country, cities and metropolitan areas are working together. They're stepping up and they're doing the hard work, particularly to grow jobs, making manufacturing a priority again, investing in infrastructure, equipping workers with the skills they need. So responsibility is devolving down in the United States to cities and metros because they're the engines of the economy. And smart cities and metros understand they have a lot of power and resources to get stuff done.
And you're saying all this is happening basically because of all the infighting, the partisan gridlock that's gripping Washington, D.C., and for that matter, many of the state capitals as well.
I think it's partly happening because of the partisan divide, both within Washington and many state capitals. I think what's also happening are cities and metros are understanding how powerful they are. In the United States, we have about 400 metropolitan areas. They're about 84% of our population, 91% of the GDP. We're the most metropolitan nation in the world. The top 100 metros alone, and Kansas City is ranked 30th by population, are about two-thirds of our population and three-quarters of our GDP. And on everything that matters to a modern economy, skilled workers, modern infrastructure, advanced research and innovation, they're at 75, 80, 85, 90% of the nation's share. So cities and metros are economic engines, very powerful, and they're beginning to act on that power with regard to those things that really matter to economic prosperity.
You know, another point that you make, and maybe we're talking almost about a psychological mindset here, but you say there's a sense around the country that cities and the leaders of those cities, Bruce, they understand that they're on their own these days. They know the gravy train out of Washington has ended. You know, how has that idea changed the thinking among mayors and other city leaders around this country?
Well, the one thing about cities and metros more broadly is that they're networks. The federal government is a government. States are governments. When you're in a city, what you have are institution and leaders from the business sector, the philanthropic sector, universities, and local government. Each on their own is powerful in their own right, but when they come together, they can do some grand things. And when I look around the United States right now, in terms of some of the very disruptive dynamics happening, but some of the great opportunities that are emerging, I see leaders and institutions at the local level really collaborating to compete around those things, infrastructure or skills or education that are going to power their places forward. So again, I think for a long time, there's been a sense in the United States that we need to look to Washington for some of our solutions. In the post-recession period, because Washington has become so dysfunctional, I think cities and metros are beginning to recognize really how many resources they have and the ability to get stuff done because they're more pragmatic, less partisan.
Well, speaking of resources that they have, Bruce, I mean, there is a flip side to the coin here, and this notion that, yes, cities may be in the driver's seat these days, but a lot of them, including Kansas City, they're so restricted by financial debt, by financial, you know, budget considerations, by struggling school systems, abandoned homes, all that stuff that have been such big issues for cities for so many years. To what extent is all of that holding them back?
Well, there's no doubt that in many parts of the country, city governments are stressed. But at the same time, other institutions within cities and within metropolitan areas, whether they're large philanthropic institutions, advanced research institutions, medical campuses, large corporations, the corporate community writ large, there are resources. And when I go around the country and I see growth and development happening within urban cores, many times around these anchor institutions, these universities and medical campuses, a lot of that's getting financed really by the private and civic sector. So we shouldn't let the balance sheet of city government obscure the wealth that exists in cities to really propel growth and development forward. And then if we're smart about this, we can do it in such a way that really connects disadvantaged populations and lower-income mm-hmm. neighborhoods to the prosperity.
But how much financial capacity is there out there for the cities? Again, a city like Kansas City carrying, you know, some serious debt that's sort of holding it back when it comes to big projects like a downtown convention hotel and growing out its very new and hasn't even started, actually, its new streetcar system here. How much financial capacity is there out there for the cities?
Well, it really depends what you're talking about.
Okay.
Right? So mm-hmm. I think, you know, these kind of investments don't exist in the general. They exist in the specific. And so what we see happening around the country are a lot of very substantial, what I would call transformative investments, are getting done in a public-private way. In some cases, it's because cities are deciding not to subsidize the next stadia or, frankly, even to subsidize the next convention center, mm-hmm. but to really put their resources and their focus and energies on transit infrastructure, mm-hmm. The streetcars that you described, and then perhaps going to the voters in a referenda, because in many cities, frankly, at the end of the day, the voters are going to have to agree to some increased taxation in exchange for these tangible projects. So depending on what the opportunity is or alternatively what the challenge is, the way it gets financed in the United States varies dramatically. We're really not like Europe. We're not like Asia. We sort of operate almost entirely as a public-private partnership in many respects. And so depending on what matters most to your region, mm-hmm. the question is how do you work out the math, you know?
Right.
And how do you work out the financing, the contributions from different sectors to get it done?
We're visiting with Bruce Katz from the Brookings Institution. His thesis is that power is shifting away from Washington and into the major metropolitan areas of the country. His new book, he's the co-author of a new book, The Metropolitan Revolution. He'll be speaking at 6:30 Wednesday evening at the Plaza Branch of the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library. To grab a seat, RSVP, just go to kclibrary.org. And by all means, if you want to join our conversation, you can do so right now. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Again, 816-235-2888. You can also email us at uptodate@kcur.org, or you can send us a tweet @kcuruptodate. Let's talk about transit for a moment and just sort of zero in on that one issue, because in the book, you point out that metros like, you know, Los Angeles and Denver and Chicago are self-financing their transit systems these days. Kansas City is doing that as well, at least with its streetcar system right now that's still being constructed. But it seems to me there's a limit as to how far these cities can go given the enormous cost of these projects like streetcars. How do you size that up, Bruce?
So the first thing is to think about the role that transit plays, because this is really not just about moving people through a congested metropolis as in LA and Denver. This is really a signal to the real estate market, to other investors, we're going to grow differently going forward. Hmm. And we're going to particularly hug these transit stops and really create mixed-use development around office, commercial, residential, innovative firms. That's why there is value to be created by transit investments, and smart places are both raising revenue. In L.A. and Denver, they use the sales tax through referenda, but then they're also using value capture around the transit stops, anticipating that there's going to be growth, more density, more real estate development. So you could basically factor that in and help that fund the system itself. The fact of the matter is that the spatial geography of innovation is shifting in the United States. Cities are being revalued. Talented workers want to live along these transit stations, stops and lines. And innovative firms want to be closer to other innovative firms. So the quintessential model of the late 20th century, you know, get in a car, drive 20 miles to an isolated corporate campus, keep your, you know, ideas secret, that is shifting radically. And transit is a big part of really growing a new geography of innovation for the future.
To what extent, Bruce, as you visit with city leaders around the country, you know, council members and mayors, to what extent are they talking about this new power dynamic in the country, this shift of power to the cities? Are they recognizing it? Are they seizing upon it? What are you sensing out there?
I think a broad segment of city leadership, not just political, but also corporate, civic, and philanthropic university, is talking about this all the time. Because I think what our book did is just capture the reality in the nation right now. Supersized challenges on one hand, a national government that's essentially left the building is on a frolic and detour. I could go on and on. It won't be surprising to anyone listening to this about the dysfunction in D.C. So cities and metros are sort of basically saying to themselves, you know, the problems are not going away. We're going to have to act in a very different way together if we're going to crack at this. And what they're discovering, you know, and the book is really a book about stories. Northeast Ohio investing in manufacturing, Portland finding their export future, Houston, innovative ways to integrate immigrants, L.A. and Denver, as you discussed, investing in transit infrastructure. This is a new way forward, incredible amount of affirmative energy. But yes, leaders around the country understand they are on their own. The cavalry is not coming. And cities and metros, particularly those like Kansas City that are really globally significant, are going to have to step up and do some grand things.
You know, you focus, you just mentioned several cities that you focused on, and you're right, this is a book of stories in such a major way. You focus on Detroit in your book, which a lot of people are going to be confused about, given that the city is bankrupt and really struggling with poverty and race and class divisions. But you seem to have some optimism for it. Tell us why.
So Detroit is a very large city. It's about 138 square miles, and it used to be close to 2 million in population. It's now less than 700,000. So it's a city of a lot of distress, fiscal and social challenges. But within the core of the city, only about 3% of the landmass, you have 40% of the jobs, you have an incredible riverfront, great bones, historic buildings, and you've got anchor institutions like Wayne State and Henry Ford Health System and the Detroit Medical Campus and the College for Creative Studies. Detroit is being renewed from its core by a group of corporate, civic, and universities that are investing back, not just in business expansion, but also residential, retail, and other growth. And I think Detroit is going to be a surprise, both to the United States and to the world, because we think about it only through one lens of almost a dystopian landscape. But if you go to Detroit today and you go to this 3% of the landmass, the core of the city, Canada sits to the south, I think you would be struck by the energy and the investment going on in this relatively small part of the city.
The question on the table this morning, what do cities need to do to attract more people, not only to have people, you know, work in the cities, but to live in them as well? Again, our number, 816-235-2888, and our email address, update@kcur.org. Well, I guess the bottom line for Detroit, Bruce, is that it can't go much lower, right?
It can't go much lower, but I think what Detroit understood and what their leadership understood and, you know, major CEOs like Dan Gilbert of Quicken Loans understood, is that 2014 is not 1974. Where people want to live, where companies want to locate, more and more are in these distinctive urban cores, because that's what you need to attract talent and to continue the, you know, very virtuous cycle of idea generation and commercialization of ideas, manufacturing. So that's what's happening in Detroit. It's happening in Cleveland, in Philly, in Boston, in Atlanta, in Houston. Frankly, Kansas City has some great assets, great attributes in the core of the city on both sides of the river to build on. The question is, are you going to have the focus and discipline to do that?
That's an interesting adjective you just used in terms of the key to cities, the key to downtowns, this word distinctive. That's so key, isn't it?
Well, yes, because I think, pre-recession, when the economy was really driven by consumption, we sort of believe that there was really no difference between a Phoenix or a Pittsburgh or a Denver and Detroit. You know, a Walmart is a Walmart is a Walmart. When you go to one of these big stores, it's the same design, same footprint, same prices, big profits. But cities are not ubiquitous. They're not uniform. They have different legacies. They grew at different times. They, you know, Kansas City, when I go to Kansas City, I know I'm in Kansas City. It's a very distinctive place, and you almost have three downtowns on the Missouri side of the border, I think grew at different times for different purposes and really sends a signal. This is a special place that has a unique economy that can be leveraged in very particular ways.
Any other thoughts as to what the Kansas City area is doing right, Bruce, maybe what it needs to reconsider?
Well, I think, you know, you've got some advanced research institutions there, Stowers, obviously, that provide an enormous space, right, for growth going forward, and particularly with regard to a certain segment of life sciences, right, because of where you're located in the United States and you're, you know, a hub of the agricultural economy. So from an economic perspective, you've done some things very right. Because, you know, you are seen, I think, both domestically and globally as having sort of a leadership role in certain advanced sectors of the economy. You know, from a physical dimension, again, going back to these three downtowns, you know, between the downtown, midtown, country club, plaza, it is incredibly distinctive landscape that you have within the city limits. I think if you project out in 25 years and you begin to think about the role that streetcars could play and density could play, mixed-use density, residential, retail, commercial office, even small batch manufacturing as that begins to return to cities, just imagine what that could look like. Right now, you don't have the kind of density that we're seeing in many other comparable metros.
Yeah.
Because so much of development has sort of sprawled out. But with some focus, some discipline, and the right infrastructure investments, you could build that. And, you know, I think not just for domestic purposes, for global purposes, it would send a very, very, very strong signal that Kansas City is ready to play in the 21st century.
Bruce Katz is our guest. He's from the Brookings Institution. His new book, The Metropolitan Revolution, we're talking about the rise of American cities as gridlock continues to grip Washington, D.C., and our nation's capital. You know, Bruce, one of the issues here has been, you know, very heavy use of tax incentives over the years to lure businesses to Kansas City. A lot of folks think the city has way overdone it. I'm wondering, how big an issue is that for other cities, and is the trend changing?
I think the trend is changing. And I think cities and their suburbs need to collaborate to compete. The competition is not with a jurisdiction 2 miles away. The competition is with global metros in Asia, Europe, and Latin America. And you're a region of 2 million people, and you need to aggregate your strengths and use your scarce resources really targeted to achieve longer-term prosperity, investing in the things that matter, like infrastructure and innovation. So when you throw tax incentives to move a company a couple miles across borders, you're really depleting your competitive advantage. other places have stopped, frankly, doing that. And they're now basically, you know, particularly a place like Greater Denver, which is not, you know, is almost the same size, you know, as Kansas City. I mean, they're really putting their resources towards, you know, global competitiveness and long-term growth. So this is a choice you have to make. You have to make it by yourself. No one's going to prohibit you from doing this mm-hmm. stuff. You've got to basically find the will and the sort of ability to reach across sectors and disciplines and jurisdictions and then to bet together on a prosperous future.
And that's such a key for our neck of the woods here because we're one of the few, maybe the only, major metropolitan community in the country that is divided right down the middle by state line. And I know Denver had issues at one point with surrounding counties, and they sort of worked through some of that. But we not only have that issue, but we have the state line on top of it. To what extent does that complicate our plight here?
Well, you're right. I mean, the market is metropolitan, and the market doesn't respect state lines, but these state lines do matter in terms of politics and policy. Other states in prior generations have been able to work together around mutual growth, and I think that's what you're going to have to sort out. It starts, I think, at the city metropolitan level. I mean, the same way we don't need to wait for Washington, we don't need to wait for governors or state legislatures. We'll be waiting a very long time. You know? Mm-hmm. So I think if the key corporate, civic, political, and university leaders on both sides of that state line call a moratorium, right, mm-hmm. on these kind of stealing business activities, and then get the state to reinforce it, then I think you're on the road, you know, back to sanity and frankly, towards growth. So the bottom line is who has agency in the United States? Who can, you know, set a destiny for their places? These are the engines of our economy. The rest of the world, frankly, is becoming more like us. You know, when we talk about the rise of China, the rise of India, the rise of Brazil, they're urbanizing. They're industrializing. They are becoming more like the United States. We got there first, and now we need to grow a new kind of governance at these local and metropolitan levels so that we can remain globally competitive. It's a brutal world out there.
Yeah.
And I don't think there's really any other choice but to do what we're recommending.
You know, we just have a few minutes left. I wanted to turn your attention to some of the other metropolitan communities around the country that you've alluded to here today and the things that they've done to sort of turn the corner. You know, again, you focus on Northeast Ohio, which, again, might surprise some folks, groups using industrial-age skills to invent new 21st-century materials, tools, and processes. What are you seeing in Northeast Ohio, Bruce?
So this gets back to a broader point about the economy post-recession. The United States still makes things, right? We still have a manufacturing base. And a lot of that base is located in places like Northeast Ohio. It's not large companies necessarily. It's small and medium-sized manufacturers. They may be suppliers to large companies in the auto or aerospace sector, or they may be trading abroad. They need help and support, not from just government, but from institutions that can help them strengthen their business plan, retool their facilities, access capital, retrain workers. That's what's happening in Northeast Ohio. Philanthropy and business coming together across four metros within the state of Ohio so that they can leverage their manufacturing base. And this is a signal, I think, to the world that Northeast Ohio, Southeast Michigan, these are places that are ready to make things again, both for domestic consumption and global consumption.
Give us a glimpse into Houston and the immigration there and how that's changing the landscape down there.
Well, Houston is an economic powerhouse because of energy, but it also is an immigrant destination. It's one of the most diverse metros in the country. What they have grown is a network of 21st century settlement houses that are helping literally tens of thousands of immigrants integrate into the economic mainstream every year, access to low-cost banking, English as a second language. Houston thinks of these immigrants as enormous resources for the future, both in terms of as talented workers or as local entrepreneurs. And these settlement houses, backed by business, are really doing a tremendous job of accelerating the integration, assimilation of this incredible resource we have.
You know, when you last visited with us in 2008, you talked about U.S. policy toward our metros as being so disjointed, unfocused, undisciplined. I gather by what we've talked about here today, Bruce, that not a whole lot about that has changed very much.
Well, I think the national government, you know, in 2009 and 2010 was dealing with the economic cataclysm. There are some things that came out of that were helpful to cities and metros. But at the end of the day, I think in the United States, we're seeing a structural shift downward. Cities and metros really are our engines of the economy, our centers of trade. They're in the front lines of demographic transformation, as in Houston. Frankly, they're in the front lines of environmental issues. Just go to any coast and you'll find that out right away. So I think more and more our strength does not reside in the elected leadership in Washington, D.C. Our strength resides in this corporate, civic, philanthropic, this shared co-production of our economy, co-governing of our communities at the city metropolitan scale. So now there's the challenge. Are you going to be a city and metro that continues the path of division from decades past, or are you going to collaborate to compete? Therein lies your future.
Bruce Katz is the author of The Metropolitan Revolution. He's actually the co-author. And again, he speaks at 6:30 Wednesday evening at the Plaza Branch of the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library. To RSVP, go to kclibrary.org. And Bruce, know that's always a pleasure to have you. Thanks for taking some time with us.
Well, thanks for having me. Really appreciate it.